After Rome and Jerusalem, it's one of the most popular destinations for pilgrimages in the world, and one of the most mysterious places in Christianity. It is in this Pyrenean grotto that the Virgin is said to have appeared in person to the young peasant Bernadette Soubirous in the middle of the 19th century.
She does not call it by a name. She's afraid to name it, which suggests that she perhaps thinks it might be a fairy.
A grotto in which miracles have been said to have taken place.
She felt compelled to go to the grotto, and the moment she puts her hand into the water, it fully regains its agility.
Lourdes is such a holy place that it has become one of the major sanctuaries in Europe, attracting millions of pilgrims from all over the world.
Pilgrimages to Lourdes will develop globally with the appearance of railways, and this will radically change the history of pilgrimages in the West.
How did this unusual 128-acre architectural construction with three eclectic basilicas spring from the ground to produce the biggest underground crypt in the world?
St. Peter's in Rome could fit inside the Basilica of St. Pius X, even though St. Peter's is the largest basilica in Rome.
What technical challenges did the designers have to overcome for more than a century of work? How did they break down these mountains? Here is the incredible story of the construction of the Lourdes sanctuaries. In the Pyrenees Mountains, a few miles from the French-Spanish border, thousands of worshippers take part in a procession in honor of the Virgin Mary. At the heart of this incredible megastructure to God, the sanctuaries of Lourdes. An immense 128-acre space, which counts no less than three basilicas. Perched on the rock of Massabielle, the Immaculate Conception, built in the Gothic style, peaks at 328 feet above the river. Lower down, hollowed out of the same rock, the Basilica of Our Lady of the Rosary, built in the Roman Byzantine style, can welcome up to 4,000 worshippers. Its parvi, inspired by St. Peter's in Rome, can welcome 40,000 more. To the east, buried 32 feet below the surface, the Basilica of St. Pius X has the capacity for 20,000 pilgrims. With a length of 655 feet and a width of 265 feet, it's the biggest crypt ever built in the world. A sanctuary entirely built around a grotto. A sacred place where the Virgin Mary is said to have appeared 150 years earlier.
The grotto is really the heart of the sanctuary. The pilgrims themselves bear witness to the fact that there's a kind of allure to the grotto.
And for good reason, as it's here that the Mother of God is said to have revealed the existence of a spring with extraordinary properties. Water, which would be the origin of 70 unexplained healings.
It's true that the water attracts a lot of sick pilgrims hoping for a cure. Therefore, at Lourdes, you come to the source, you come to the grotto, you come to drink this water, quite simply because it's the Virgin Mary who gave us this water. Therefore, it feeds hope into the hearts of pilgrims in a very, very big way.
Catholics believe so strongly in Lourdes that it attracts millions of sick and dying pilgrims each year. Lourdes, a unique place, therefore, whose story begins in the biting cold winter of 1858. That morning, a young shepherdess, barely 14 years of age, Bernadette Soubirous, is collecting firewood on the edge of the River Gave.
She hears a loud gust of wind. She turns around and notices that the poplar trees are not moving. And at that moment, the wind no longer comes from behind her, but in front of her. And then she looks into the Massabielle Grotto.
The grotto is also known as a place of supernatural happenings, a place where fairies emerge, because they're again on this place between civilization and wildness.
And there she sees light and a woman whom she calls a beautiful woman.
And she says she does not call it by a name, which suggests that she perhaps thinks it might be a fairy, because fairies took punish people when you name them. At this moment, she doesn't seem to claim at all that it is the Virgin.
This is a region where religion and legends of goblins and giants are all mixed together. The apparition, with the appearance of a fairy that Bernadette will from now on name Akero, which means that in Patois, asks her to come back to the grotto every day for the next 2 weeks. On the 13th apparition, she assigns Bernadette a task, to deliver a mysterious message to Abbot Peyramale, the village priest.
And Bernadette is small, young, and frail, and he is a colossus of a man in the prime of his life.
And Bernadette, with unbelievable self-assurance, gives Father Peyramale this message. Tell the priests to build a chapel here, and tell people to come in procession.
So a chapel will have to be built near the Massabielle Grotto. But the rock which overhangs the grotto is 89 feet tall, and the surface is irregular. The only access is via a narrow track nicknamed Breakneck Path. The crevices in the rock weaken it and lower it down. Plus, the River Gave makes the ground spongy and prone to flooding. The request of the apparition seems impossible to meet.
So, to start with, you want me to organize a procession and build a chapel for a lady who hasn't even said her name? Plus, at the time, it's the regime of the Second Empire, so this needs authorization from the state. The state will never give authorization for that.
If the Abbot Peyramale is skeptical, this is not the case of the villagers, who seem literally bewitched by the young shepherdess. From now on, they will be in their hundreds, and then thousands, accompanying her to each of the apparitions.
And they are impressed. She's transfigured from sort of flea-ridden girl in rags of wool into something people perceive as very beautiful. There is something about the solemnity of her embodiment that really does make people watch her with respect.
During the recitation of the rosary, Bernadette says, "The lady is here, the lady is here." And at the same time, Bernadette goes into a profound ecstasy. Then asks the lady her name four times. And on the fourth time, the lady says, "I am the Immaculate Conception."
On the way home, Bernadette, scared of forgetting, repeats to herself this strange string of words that she doesn't know. Que soy era Immaculada Concepción. Abbot Peyramale is stunned. How can a young shepherdess who doesn't know how to read or write, how can she know these terms which are only known to theologians?
And Father Peyramale doesn't give any explanations to Bernadette. He starts crying because he understands that Bernadette has seen a lady, a beautiful lady, and that lady is the Virgin Mary.
From then on, convinced of the truth of the apparitions, he informs the Bishop of Tarbes, Monseigneur Bertrand Sévère Laurence.
And he says, there's something going on in our community, there's an élan mystique, there's a renewal of faith. And not only a renewal of faith, but a kind of ethical consciousness that is emerging, that people are becoming, in a sense, holier because of the events. There is no doubt that Laurence, who comes out of the attempts by the church in this period to reconstitute itself in the aftermath of the revolution sees this as a chance for reconversion.
And what better way to evangelize a country than with a new place for pilgrimages? A chapel which had been requested by the Mother of God herself. The bishop believes that the future edifice should be dedicated to the Immaculate Conception, whose worship was proclaimed 4 years earlier in 1854 by Pope Pius IX.
That it becomes dogma is very important because it is the ultimate miracle of faith. Mary is not just giving birth as a virgin, she is also conceived herself without sin. And Pius is concerned to multiply these miracles of faith in contrast to what he sees as the errors, which are rationalism, liberalism, scientism.
But the bishop is careful because the infatuation with Bernadette could dwindle at any moment. Recognizing the apparitions too early could put him in an awkward position vis-a-vis the church. It's therefore with great discretion that he meets an architect known for his devotion and his great piety.
Hippolyte Durand is the architect who is approached. He is a diocesan architect. Hippolyte Durand was involved in a new movement which veered towards recapturing the Middle Ages by searching for examples in the great cathedrals, and who would like to restore Christian faith through architecture.
The man who was the architect of the Château de Monte Cristo, built for Alexandre Dumas, gains the trust of the bishop. He immediately gets to work. Durand opts for a Roman Byzantine style. As is the tradition, he positions the future chapel towards the rising sun, symbolic of Christ illuminating the world at the first light of dawn. Access will be to the west, following Breakneck Path. But just at the time when he was about to present his plans, the bishop makes a surprising request.
We must think of a way to organize the pilgrimage and the way in which the pilgrims live so that the pilgrims can enjoy a place of rest. We will ask the architect to change the direction of the church. Instead of positioning it to the east, the choir will be to the west, the side where it rains. And the eastern part will be the entrance to the chapel. Actually, in this porch, the pilgrims could find shelter and sleep.
In this way, the pilgrims will be protected from the rain and from the prevailing winds. But the chapel will lose one of the strongest symbols of Christian worship.
The positioning of the church must have been quite revolutionary, but what exactly won the deal was that to compensate for the space, to adjust to the level of the hillock, the architect suggested adding a crypt. And this crypt was exactly above the mandala where the Blessed Virgin appeared. So, as a result, it was possible for the crypt to be at the symbolic heart of Lourdes.
On the 18th of January, 1862, the bishop signed an official declaration recognizing the reality of the apparitions.
To comply with the wishes of the Blessed Virgin, we suggest building a sanctuary on the grounds of the grotto.
Works will be fully funded by donations from worshippers. All that's left to be done is for the bishop to organize the pilgrimage to make Lourdes the jewel of the Catholic reconquest of France. On the 13th of October, 1862, early in the morning, a huge explosion resonates on the Espelugas mountain. The demolition work for the building of the Immaculate Conception has just started. Abbot Peyramale is enthusiastic.
It's a pleasure to see the rock smashed to smithereens in the exploding mines. On the other side of the Pyrenees, where the echoes must carry these detonations, they must think there are terrible battles going on.
There was a rocky outcrop in the middle of the ground, and so before starting work, they had to blow this up to try and level the ground a bit. It was a huge task, especially as they had to make sure when working above the grotto not to disrupt the ground too much, which could weaken it. It's really an important element in the construction of the sanctuaries. So for all the work that was done, major precautions were taken.
At the same time, the architect Hippolyte Durand is putting the finishing touches to his new project. The chapel will be neo-Gothic in style. It will be 167 feet in length, 69 feet wide, and 62 feet high. The spire will be 305 feet high above the gave. To bear the weight of such a mass of stone, powerful 7 feet thick and 65 feet tall walls will be supported by 7 powerful buttresses and connected to the rock by chains fixed to it. The grotto will be left in its original state.
The idea to keep the grotto as untouched as possible is still an idea that appeals to everyone. We wanted it as close as possible to how Bernadette experienced it. We placed the statue of the Virgin exactly where Bernadette saw her, to give a visual idea of how the grotto was at the time, and to keep this image as a strong image of Lourdes.
In the month of August 1863, the work on the support walls is finished. It cost 300,000 francs, a fortune at the time. It's necessary to quickly launch another appeal for donations. And for that, the bishop can count on the notoriety of the pilgrimage and especially on the spring revealed by Bernadette 5 years earlier during the ninth apparition.
Bernadette is on her knees. She's doing penance. And then the lady says, "Drink from the fountain and wash yourself." And she shows her a place under the rock. And she scratches at the ground with her hands. And it feels moist.
A spring coming from nowhere, emanating from the depths of the earth. For the hundreds of witnesses present that day, there was no doubt. This water can only be a divine gift.
So from the moment when she discovered the source, people will start to return in the afternoon to widen it, etc. The water began to flow, so I find that quite a beautiful symbol. The more we drank, the more there was. It was not going to run out.
Water, which is soon going to drastically change the fate of Lourdes, when a woman who'd been paralyzed in her right hand for many months visits the grotto in Massabielle.
Catherine Latapie, who lives 7 miles from Lourdes in a village called Loubajac, feels compelled to go to the grotto. The moment she puts her hand into the water, it fully regains its agility.
Miracle or not, in the months which follow, there will be dozens who attest to having benefited from inexplicable healing. Is the water from Lourdes miraculous? The mayor of the village would like to be sure.
The mayor is deeply moved and understands very quickly that maybe Bernadette has just discovered a thermal spring. And it's for that reason that the town hall gets the water analyzed. At first, by a pharmacist who also understands what's at stake and whose analysis may be a bit biased, and he suggests that it is, in fact, thermal water. But a second analysis confirms the reality, that the Massabielle water is normal for that part of the Pyrenees.
Pyrenees. If the mayor sees his dream of a thermal spa fade away, the bishop sees the potential in this water, which in principle has no recognized properties, but which, however, could be capable of curing the incurable. From that moment on, Lourdes becomes the last chance pilgrimage for thousands of sick people. A pilgrimage which, in 1867, will be able to rely on the arrival of the first railway line in the valley.
In this year, a Basque abbot, Abbot Laparade from Bayonne, had an idea, which will in fact turn out to be a great idea, to organize a special train for the pilgrims. So the railways will organize the transport for the sick. From then on, the pilgrimage to Lourdes will develop on a European level, then global, with the advent of the railways.
A massive influx of pilgrims means financial mana, which is going to play into the hands of the bishop. Because the works for the chapel are more expensive than initially thought, the bishop will resort to a new technique in vogue at the time, photography. Prints of Bernadette that the pilgrims will literally fall over themselves to buy.
These photographs were staged, which show at moments her grief and annoyance at being pushed to reproduce for the camera a certain vision of her spirituality and her trances.
It's a means of propaganda, yes, that's clear. Bernadette will say, I'm being sold for so much? Oh, if that's what I'm worth, well.
An icon who is selling well, but who is soon going to be in the way. During the inauguration of the crypt, the young woman is a guest of the festivities, but the bishop wants, at all costs, to avoid her being the star. So the young woman attends the ceremony dressed as a child of Mary and firmly escorted by nuns.
The danger was, of course, that it wouldn't be the veneration of the Virgin, but it might become the veneration of Bernadette. That was what the church worried about.
2 months later, on the 4th of July, 1866, Bernadette leaves Lourdes for the Saint-Gildas de Nevers convent in Brittany, where she will take the veil. She will never come back to see her mountains nor the grotto of Massabielle until her death. On the site, the works advance at the rhythm that the funds are collected and is dependent on the capricious weather. Luckily, Hippolyte Durand can rely on one advantage which will gain him several precious months, the many quarries present around the village.
Lourdes is a town of stonecutters, and at the moment of the apparitions, there are roughly 200 families who make a living from working with stone. Lourdes is stone, marble, and slate. It is these same workers, these same stonecutters, who will be hired to build the Basilica of the Immaculate Conception.
The stones are carried by carts and come from the town where the pilgrims who want to go to the grotto are already numerous. They use the same path. So with all these people in the same place, they have to make sure there are no accidents, no carts overturning on the pilgrims.
A narrow space which forces Hippolyte Durand to make certain concessions regarding the plan of the chapel.
He couldn't really adapt the Gothic architectural plan to the location. He had to adapt to the land. So for that reason, he couldn't build a transept, nor could he make large flying buttresses to strengthen these archways.
These buttresses are usually present in Gothic churches and counterbalance the weight that the archways exert on the walls. An omission which, in the long run, could have proved catastrophic for the solidity of the building. But the architect is going to have an ingenious idea.
He installed lateral chapels along the nave, which are linked with each other, and which also allowed for the creation of a sort of ambulatory. From these chapels, we can see that the walls are relatively large because it's these which play the role of buttresses.
Thanks to his ingenuity, Hippolyte Durand achieved the feat of building a church that can accommodate 1,000 worshippers on a steep, narrow, rocky outcrop. On the 15th of August, 1871, the Chapel of the Immaculate Conception is inaugurated. A ceremony during which one man is noticeable by his absence, Monseigneur Lawrence, who died several months earlier during a trip to Rome. He leaves behind him the first piece of a vast enterprise destined to become one of the biggest sanctuaries in the world. But before becoming an important place of national pilgrimage, Lourdes still has to pass one final test, obtaining recognition from its peers. One year earlier, in 1870, chaos takes over the country as Prussia inflicts a stinging defeat on the French army, causing the fall of Napoleon III and the Second Empire. France is humiliated. For the majority of French Catholics and those close to the monarchists, it's no coincidence.
Many Catholics believed this notion that France was the eldest daughter of the Catholic Church, and that once it deviated from that mission, then this was when things started to go wrong. They had to engage in acts of repentance and move back to a vision of France that they thought had been lost, certainly since the Revolution of 1789.
At Lourdes, a priest, Abbé Chocarn, is going to have a revelation. A plan which could have been whispered to him by God himself to redeem the sins of France.
He is celebrating Mass in the Chapel of the Immaculate Conception. And there, during Mass, he is distracted. He understood that the Virgin summons the sick to Lourdes. But who is sick? France is sick. How else to interest the Virgin in the fate of France if not by doing what she asks for? And what does she ask for? For processions. Joining together at Lourdes all the Marian sanctuaries in France.
Through the sanctuaries dedicated to the Virgin Mary, it's the entire nation who will do penance. A pilgrimage which they hope will have at least 10,000 participants. In the village, the 4,000 inhabitants get involved in offering lodgings and shelter. Above all, the sanctuary, from now on, can count on a true army of pious and devout women to welcome the sick.
There is no way that we can understand the Lourdes phenomenon without coming to grips with the role of women in promoting these kinds of devotions. So what you get is an increasingly woman's institution, still run by men, and still within a very patriarchal mold, because the men, of course, are still running the show.
On the 5th of October, 1872, a human tide descends on the Pyrenean city. In 3 days, 120,000 hosts are consecrated. Representatives of 300 sanctuaries march with 320 banners.
There is an enormous amount of people. We will count 70,000 people on the day of the march.
Lourdes, for most of the period that it's in operation, can mobilize larger crowds than any labor movement on the left.
So we exceeded everything we thought possible.
Since then, the pilgrimage has become national. Delegations from all the French dioceses will come to Lourdes each year. So the entire country will be devoted to the Virgin Mary. Strengthened by its success, the Basilica receives grace from Pope Pius IX, who raises the status of the Chapel of the Immaculate Conception to the rank of minor basilica. From now on, nothing can stop the incredible ascension of this Pyrenean city.
The town will be transformed by the Lourdes pilgrimage, as Lourdes will devote itself to welcoming pilgrims. So how does this work at the beginning? The people of Lourdes see all these people arriving, so they begin opening boarding houses, and then the first hotels arrive, so that soon all the left bank of the Gave will become a hotel zone.
A A dazzling success, which the new Bishop of Tarbes, Monseigneur Benoît-Marie L'Engenieur, must cope with. Because, barely finished, the Basilica of the Immaculate Conception is no longer sufficient to absorb the uninterrupted flow of pilgrims.
Monseigneur L'Engenieur, in front of all these pilgrims, thinks, if we're going to leave them outside to celebrate Mass, we're going to need altars, etc. There are an enormous amount of things, and he thinks a new church is needed.
In 1883, approaching the 25th anniversary of the apparitions, pilgrims come in mass. For the new church, a new architect is approached, Leopold Hardy, the chief architect of the two international expositions in Paris.
The idea behind his project was obviously not to go down the Gothic route, since the Gothic style with its big ogival archways would create a problem of height, with a part of the Immaculate Conception being hidden. So it was necessary to construct a building less elevated.
For this, Hardy pictured a church in the style of Roman Byzantine, because this type of building, in the form of a Greek cross, has the advantage of having a dome. Seated on four enormous pillars, it will give enough space to welcome 4,000 pilgrims, but above all, it will allow him to limit its height to 43 feet.
Here, the architect has been extremely intelligent and respectful, because he has slid his building under the Basilica of the Immaculate Conception, that we often call the Superior Basilica. So you have the impression that it's only one building, or if you approach it, you have the feeling that the Basilica of Our Lady of the Rosary serves as a pedestal, as support for the Basilica above.
On each side, gigantic arcades will support ramps that will rise to the Superior Basilica. With a gentle slope of 4 inches per yard, they will facilitate the pilgrimage. They encircle a vast parvis of 427 by 279 feet, in which 40,000 people can assemble, enough for the sanctuaries to realize their ambitions for decades. On the 16th of July, 1883, the construction of the Rosary Church starts, 25 years to the day after the last apparition. But the first trenches are barely dug when Leopold Hardy is urgently called to the building site.
There was a canal, the Merlas Canal, which passed just below. And there was also the water from the Gave. So the ground was quite porous at that place and quite humid,
resulting in the entire foundations being submerged underwater.
So they had to drain it to extract all the water that was there in order to construct a relatively sound edifice.
And that's not the end of Hardy's problems. To clear the space necessary for this future edifice, 353,000 cubic feet of rock was taken from the mountain with large explosive reinforcements. The new basilica will literally be built into the rock. But water flowing from the top of the mountain to the valley could endanger the walls of the basilica in the long term. The architect will have a clever idea. Isolate the building from the rock with the help of a separation gallery.
So we arrive here in a very private part of the Rosary Church, as here is the interface between the wall of the Rosary Chapel, the Basilica, and here the support wall holding the rock. Therefore, at the moment of the building, it was decided to separate these two walls and thus make a kind of protection.
To consolidate his masonry, Hardy will place landfill arches all along the corridor.
Lourdes is a place where there is a lot of earthquakes. So you also have to balance the mass so that it can last for years to come.
To avoid pockets of water accumulating behind the support wall, the architect has holes made in the rock wall through which water can flow into the gutter.
We have the impression that we're in a grotto, and we find here the formation of stalactites, stalagmites, limestone which stays on the surface, and the water runs along it. And therefore, in Lourdes, we can see water in all its forms. We have the miraculous water which comes from the grotto and which heals, and then we have the water from the rock which runs here, but which could also have been a disruptive element for the architecture.
Six years is enough time to finish the structural work. Now, all that is left is the interior design. The church will be devoted to the Rosary, a prayer ritual dedicated to the Virgin Mary. It will comprise 15 chapels, each one decorated with one of the 15 mysteries of faith, a life-size summary of the Gospel.
We wanted this basilica to illustrate the rosary prayer, as if the basilica itself was, in a way, a huge rosary. The Basilica of Our Lady of the Rosary is a type of instruction for the pilgrims. And so, through the images, it's always the will of the Church to be able to, and today it's very fashionable, to be able to evangelize.
A handy tool for converting souls. It remains to find a material capable of resisting the extreme climatic conditions of the valley. By chance, a technique as old as Herod has just been brought up to date: mosaic.
The advantage of mosaic compared to paint is that it's more durable, and once it's placed, as long as there's no disturbance in the stability of the wall, it will never move. If you think of the mosaics in Rome or Pompeii, they're still there and in perfect condition.
The execution of this decoration will be supervised by Domenico Facchina, the most famous mosaicist in France, because this man has developed a revolutionary laying technique. Instead of posing the tesseras one by one on the wall, as you do traditionally, the designs are put together on a base in the workshop. These are then stuck on the wall in reverse. The execution time is thus considerably reduced. In this way, the 15 chapels will be covered in 16,000 square feet of mosaics for a total cost of 450,000 francs. Which is the equivalent of 1.8 million euros, an incredible fortune.
If France gave, I was going to say, the majority of the money for the construction of the Basilica of the Immaculate Conception, it's now the whole world which will participate in the construction of the Basilica of Our Lady of the Rosary.
In less than three decades, the Lourdes sanctuaries have become very profitable. The walls of the chapels are covered, bit by bit, in thousands of marble plaques, testimony to the extraordinary healing and donations in hard currency. But in September 1891, while the building site of the Rosary was far from being finished and still needing financing, a man arriving by train from Paris will single-handedly cause trouble and stir up the church as far as the Holy See. At the beginning of autumn, Émile Zola, the famous author of Germinal and the Beast Within, discovers the city of Lourdes for the first time, attracted by the innumerable miracles supposedly taking place there. A distinguished guest for whom the sanctuaries roll out the red carpet.
Zola comes with the national pilgrimage and will want to see the sick and to witness medical consultations. He sees the returning Clémentine Trouvé, who was cured in the national pilgrimage of 1891.
They have a belief that they will convert him.
Zola does not believe in the apparitions for one second, nor the cures. In August 1894, the writer publishes Lourdes, an incendiary novel accusing the church of making substantial profits at the expense of the sick. In barely 2 months, the book becomes a bestseller.
The writing of his book dedicated to Lourdes will be poorly received by the Catholics, who will feel humiliated. He says that Bernadette had experienced hallucinations.
His book is a combat weapon. He's basically saying, they are liars, they are hypocrites, they are thieves.
The matter reaches the Holy See, who is worried. The book is forbidden by the Congregation of the Index, who pose a ban absolutely prohibiting Christians to read it.
And they are afraid that there's a persuasive power in Zola's prose that might actually probably affect Catholics and undermine their faith. After that, that you see the multiplication of caricatures in the Catholic press of Zola as a kind of demonic person.
Finally, the counter-propaganda works. Donations continue to roll in. Zola will not bring down the work on the rosary. Ironically, the sanctuaries will even find a way of using the novelist to give the chapel its final touch.
To do penance, to ask forgiveness for what Zola has written, the Bishop of Lourdes will ask the population to donate money for the organs for the Basilica of Our Lady of the Rosary in compensation.
Thereby finishing the works on both the Basilica of the Immaculate Conception and the Basilica of Our Lady of the Rosary. But in Lourdes, where the ambitions are always getting bigger and bigger, a new bishop will again put on workman's overalls and bring the sanctuaries into the modernity and gigantism of the new century. In 1953, the new Bishop of Taub, Monsignor Theas, faces a daunting challenge. The organization of the Centennial of the Apparitions, an event which will be attended by 5 million pilgrims. But for almost 50 years, nothing more has been built in the sanctuaries.
He understands that the reception capacities are too small, hence his idea of building a huge place of worship.
A place where we can have processions on the days when it rains. And it rains a lot in Lourdes.
And so the idea was to build a basilica which could accommodate 20,000 people.
But an edifice capable of offering such a capacity would be impossible to build to classical architectural standards for a reasonable sum. The solution will come from Rome, where Pope Pius XII has recently undertaken a profound liturgical reform.
It just so happens that Pius XII had just published an apostolic letter called Mediator Dei, where he mentions contemporary art. And Pius XII feels the need for churches to also live by this art.
The future church will, therefore, be resolutely modern and made from concrete. A revolutionary choice at the time, but one which has the advantage of being more economical than stone. An architect is approached, Pierre Vago, because this man, a big fan of Le Corbusier, is the founder of a prestigious journal on contemporary architecture.
He will explain to Monseigneur Theas that if he envisages a superstructure with 20,000 seats, it will completely obscure the chapel of the Immaculate Conception. We would have had a type of colossal hangar, enormous, which would have completely dwarfed the entire site of the grotto. So it would be better to put the church underground.
The future edifice will be buried under the vast meadow which borders the Gave. It will be constrained to the south by the road which runs along the sanctuaries, and to the north by the path which links the crowned virgin with St. Michael's Gate. Made in an elliptical shape reminiscent of a fish, symbolizing the first Christians, it will measure 656 feet long and 262 feet wide.
There's not really a plan. It's a mandala, which is in the style of the hole in which the Blessed Virgin appears in the grotto. And so the building corresponded exactly to the intentions at the start of the project, to create a structure in the image of Bernadette, modest, simple.
It's an extremely bold choice. In 1959, it's clear that there are few people who like this style.
It is imperative that the building is finished in less than 5 years, in time for the centennial of the apparitions. The cost is estimated at 2 billion francs, which is the equivalent of 36 million euros, and once again, the faithful will be asked to contribute. In December 1955, after the bishop has validated the plans, a problem needs to be solved: the roof of the future edifice. The engineers suggest a vast crypt supported by pillars, an idea which is not approved by Pierre Vago, who wants the building as stripped back as possible. So he contacts Eugène Freycinet, inventor of a new revolutionary method of construction, pre-stressed concrete. A technique which permits the building of long concrete archways without intermediate support.
Freycinet created an immense hall without any pillars inside this huge volume. Everything is completely liberated by the fact that we have these big pre-stressed concrete structures which can completely absorb the space.
Two series of 58 semi-arches resting on a long central beam will support the roof. First, the concrete is poured into a formwork. Then, steel cables are slid in a sheath placed in the lower part of the beam. Hydraulic jacks then tension the cables to prevent the beam from collapsing. Compressed, the concrete thereby becomes pre-stressed. Thus, the edifice will have a surface nearly as big as St. Peter's Basilica in Rome, 156,000 square feet, and without any central pillars.
It's said that St. Peter of Rome could be contained inside the Basilica of St. Pius X, even though St. Peter's is the largest basilica in Rome.
The official start of construction is given as the 30th of May 1956. But when the excavation has just passed 7 feet deep, water will once again appear, transforming the giant hole into a real-size lake.
All the priests who were coming noted this space filled with water. And this water worried them. They said, "What does it mean? We won't be able to build on it, etc."
At the same time, Monseigneur Théas received the first invoices, which add up to 300 million francs. But the funding only managed to raise a few dozen. A wind of panic blows on the French episcopate and becomes a national affair.
The bills were arriving for Monseigneur Théas, who needed to pay them. And he had no money to pay the companies who were doing the work. And the best had been chosen. So there came a time when effectively the bishop said, "Well, we have to stop everything."
They raised the question of filling that hole back in. They were going to fill it in.
An order validated by the Holy See itself. Desperate, the bishop turned to the Virgin. However, the miracle is going to come from his construction manager.
It's Campenon Bernard who tells him, "You must obey." So you have to stop the works, but I'm continuing. I'm going to pay the workers who are destined to continue the work from my own pocket, so that it will be finished on the date and time we had decided on for the centennial of the apparitions. And if Compagnon Bernard hadn't done that, I don't think we would ever have had the Basilica of St. Pius X.
The architects brought in by Vago find a clever technical solution to overcome the water infiltration. A metal curtain comprising steel blades 12 inches in width and 59 feet long will be placed along the 1,600 feet circumference of the building. These blades will be driven into the ground to a depth of 59 feet, thus creating a barrier stemming the flow of water around the future edifice. Finally, to avoid any infiltration, a system of channels under the gigantic concrete slab will drain the water thanks to a pump up to 26 feet deep and eject it back into the Gave.
This system has been in place since the opening of the Basilica, and there have never been any problems. The system has been so well planned, thought out. We have a principle of tubing, which allows for the complete drainage of this building, which floats a bit on the water, but everything is drained.
On the 18th of July, 1957, the work can finally restart. First, the water is pumped to dry the foundations. The arches are then poured into gigantic formworks. And then, an incredible concrete structure arises from the ground. In less than 6 months, the skeleton of the future basilica is in place. The 129,000 square feet of the roofing is covered in pre-stressed concrete slabs and 4,000 tons of earth. Inside, the decoration is minimalist.
Vago chose an architecture which completely manifests contemporary art. The Basilica of St. Pius X is extremely bare, very stripped back, without decoration. He didn't want statues, leaving the supports, the crutches of the archways, and the resolutely modern architecture on show.
The choir, traditionally situated at the back of the church, is placed in the center of the building. A revolution at the time where the liturgy imposes the priests to do mass with their backs to the faithful.
The idea of placing the altar in the center was indeed something new, original. If you put the altar at the end of a vast ellipse, the people, the furthest back, are 650 feet away. At the time it was constructed, there weren't any televisions inside.
On the 24th of March, 1958, the basilica is consecrated in front of thousands of believers. It's the Archbishop of Venice, Angelo Roncalli, who will become Pope John XXIII several months later, who is in charge of the blessing.
All the dioceses in France and Europe assemble, and the influx is a constant coming and going. All the people of Lourdes will tell you that they have never seen so many people at Lourdes, and this will stay forever in their memory.
Thereby finishing the construction of the sanctuaries of Lourdes, a huge place of worship and pilgrimages, which continues to attract millions of pilgrims from five continents 160 years after its creation. Each attracted by an indelible faith in the miracles and the singular story of a young shepherdess who has since become one of the most worshipped saints in the world.